From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. Streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview from the archives with novelist and short story writer J. Robert Lennon. He lives in Ithaca, New York. When we spoke in 2014, we discussed his story collection, See You in Paradise, published by Grey Wolf Press. Last year, he published two more books with Grey Wolf, a novel called Subdivision and a story collection, Let Me Think. I began our interview by asking him to read the opening paragraph from his story, Zombie Dan. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
They figured out how to bring people back to life. Not everybody, just some people. And this is what happened to our friend, Dan Larson. He had died falling off a yacht, and 6 months later, there he was, driving around in his car, nodding, licking his pale, thin lips, wearing his artfully distressed sport jackets and brown leather shoes.
That's great. Thank you. First of all, I loved that story, Zombie Dan. My question has to do with the beginnings of stories. You have this way of starting a story so that as a reader I feel really grounded pretty quickly, even though the story is almost certainly going to surprise me very soon. But you have this way of letting us know exactly where we stand. It's not at all coy. You know, your story lets us know what's happening, at least what we need to know from the start. I wonder if you can just talk about what the beginning of a story can or should do, in your opinion.
Well, I think a story needs to tell you how it's going to be read. What I always tell my students is you can do literally anything. You can persuade people that anything is real as long as you let them know rhetorically how they are to take it. So, when a story does unexpected things that are so unexpected that they're outside the frame of reference of the story, the result is often confusion. You know, in workshop with undergraduates, there's at least once a semester – There's a moment where we get to the end of the workshop and everyone thinks some ridiculous thing, like that the character was a ghost.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Or on the other hand, it's something else like, oh, well, it was actually from the toaster's point of view the whole time, right? It's some kind of secret.
Yes.
Or mistake that was made because the writer has failed to provide the correct frame of reference to read the story in. So I usually use George Saunders as an example of how you can use tone to indicate what sort of plot, characters, and combination of the two the reader can expect.
Okay, great. That actually reminds me of something that's going to seem really not at all related, but did you ever used to watch Star Trek the Next Generation?
Sure.
So you remember the character Q?
Yeah.
So my husband and I hated those episodes because every time Q was there, anything at all, like at the very end, he could just toss the ship into like seven galaxies away, and it was like all of a sudden you're like, what? No, that's not okay. So.
No, he was like, he was the manifestation of narrative discontinuity.
There you go.
It's not fair.
Yeah. So you're setting some rules up in the beginning of a story.
Yeah.
To ground the reader or make the reader feel comfortable. And then if things are going to change, you're going to let them know as that happens, basically?
Yeah. Not, you know, to an extent. Essentially, that first paragraph, I want to establish the world of the story, which
right.
is to say, darkly comic and a little bit over the top. But not so far over the top that people are flying around in hovercrafts, you know, and they're aliens.
But a portal might show up in the backyard, but you're going to tell us about
that's
it.
That's true. That could happen.
And actually, I wanted to talk about that. So, you know, your work often has a sort of strange little thread running through it, normalcy. I wrote down normalcy obstructed by sort of dark events or occurrences or strangeness. And I loved this line from Portal, which is actually the opening story in the collection. I guess the things that scare you are the things that are almost normal. I loved that line.
Yeah.
I wondered if we could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, that's kind of, I mean, I don't write, I wouldn't say that I write magic realism, but I think it's kind of a rule of magic realism is that you don't make everything crazy. You make one thing unusual.
Right.
And, you know, that when we are creeped out by something or when we find something uncanny but persuasive, that it's one little thing that's different. And in the case of this story, it's that everything is normal. It's a family having problems communicating with each other, and they're dealing with the troubles of having an old house in the country with problems. And one of the problems is that their magic portal is broken. And, you know, in the world of this story, it's not at all unusual that there would be a portal, a magic portal in the house, but they didn't even realize there was one, and it turns out that it's on the fritz, and then, like, do we get rid of it, or do we repair it? And what they, of course, do is use it,
right.
Which leads them to all kinds of adventures that expose the cracks in their family.
Now, you said something interesting a minute ago, that you don't see your work as magical realism, which I didn't think it was as I read it. But now that you've said that, I'm wondering, what would you say is the difference?
Oh, geez, I don't really know.
Is it humor? I'm thinking magical realism doesn't tend to be really funny.
Yeah, the problem with that term is that it used to be used to describe one guy.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Now it's used to describe everything that's peculiar.
Yeah.
I would just say that, you know, I'm a writer of literary fiction that sometimes borrows from other genres. So I might borrow, in the case of the two stories we've mentioned, science fiction. I like crime stories, and so my stories often have crime in them, though I did write one police procedural novel that has not seen the light of day and maybe never will. But there are aspects of other genres that I've enjoyed as well. So, yeah, I don't – someone was just asking me what – someone else just asked me what literary fiction was, and I was very tempted to just run away from the phone, throw it into the fire and run away. But,
right, and I don't mean to be all genre, you know, related in this question. I just am thinking, well, magical realism usually – I don't know. I could see this
being
called.
I'm the one who said magical realism.
I know you are, but you said not. So.
Yeah.
I'll just move us away from that, so you don't have to run away. All right. Your characters oftentimes are dealing with really heavy burdens. They not to generalize, but they don't seem very happy, or else maybe they just don't seem to expect happiness in their lives. And I'm thinking of really obvious examples, like there's a character named Loreen in a story called The Wraith in this collection, but also there's the sadly titled No Life. And more subtle examples, like Jerry in The Portal, who comes to regret some of the decisions that they make. And I don't know, there's this melancholy sometimes. So I was wondering if you are aware of doing this, of course you must be, as you write for your characters.
Yeah, I am aware of it. And I'm not quite sure where it comes from. I mean, I'm a fairly happy, generally cheerful person, but I think that melancholy is a very, very big part of my life, and it's detached entirely from the circumstances of my life, which are by and large very good. I'm very fortunate in that respect, but I'm often sad, and not sad like as in I'm grappling with depression, as many people I know are. It's merely just I'm kind of blue a lot of the time, and I feel like melancholy is never more than an arm's reach away from wherever I happen to be. So that's what I end up writing about a lot.
Now, not to get too personal, but again, you brought it up. But so do you think that the sadness you feel is, like with Loreen, related to this terrible stuff that exists in the world and reading the news every day and that sort of thing?
There was a time, and that story came out of a time right around the sort of Abu Ghraib revelation, that my wife and I were more politically engaged than we are now, and I think day in and day out had a sense of futility and anger about things that were very terrible and were happening very far away, over which we had almost no influence whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And my novel Castle came out of that period too, which is about an Iraq war veteran who's sort of failing to deal with his past, essentially. In a semi-rural setting.
Okay.
Actually, that is a description of my life, actually. Failing to deal with my past in a semi-rural setting. These days, I feel it's like, I don't know, life is finite, and everything is beautiful, and I want to apprehend it and experience it all day long, and it's never quite close enough.
Okay.
Does that make sense? How have you gotten me to this point after only 10 minutes?
I know, I'm sorry. Okay. We'll move on. We'll go to something else. So,
you're burning through these topics.
Oh, I got lots. I got so many. Okay. Let's go back to Portal for a minute. Sometimes, and not just in Portal, but that's an example. Sometimes you provide a sense of what is to come or what might have been if things had turned out differently. You'll have these little lines. And another example is the story, Weber's Head.
Right? Weber's Head, yeah.
Where your narrator describes this seemingly fine qualities of a potential roommate and says, at the time, these seemed like good portents. Right? Yeah. And so then we have that to kind of go like, oh, something's about to, you know, make this not a true statement. So can you talk about these little asides that you sometimes put in there?
I think you've identified, I hadn't noticed this before, you'd identified sort of a trademark a trick in my work, which is like goofy foreboding.
Is it a trick?
maybe it is. Well, someone asked me to do a self-interview for their website, which is really an invitation to appear to be the worst person in the entire world, essentially. And that's one of the things that I ask myself is that, you know, are you just, you know, is it all a trick? Or is this a series of gimmicks? So in a way it is a trick, but I like to think it's a good trick. And I have a lot of them in my bag of them.
Well, would you say that readers deserve a certain satisfaction of suspense being created for them?
Sure. And, well, I don't know if they deserve it, but I know that it's something that I like as a reader. Mm-hmm. Whether that suspense comes from plot or character or even style and tone. And I feel like these kind of comic asides that promise future drama is a thing that I enjoy reading and a thing that I enjoy doing as well.
Yeah. Yeah. You have this great comic line. Actually, I wanted to ask you about the humor. And now I've moved it. I edit these moments.
Oh, you shouldn't. Keep it natural.
Keep it natural. Okay. I'll leave it in. I don't see it here. So there was this great moment, again, in Portal, where they've discovered the portal. Oh, here it is. And sure enough, off to the left, kind of hovering above what had looked like another bench, but now appeared more like a short, curved little staircase, was this oval, sort of man-sized, shimmering thing that honestly just screamed, magic portal. I mean, it was totally obvious what it was. Nothing else gives the air that quality, that kind of electrical distortion, like heat or whatever is bending space itself. This was a real surprise to us because there had been nothing about it in the real estate ad.
Yeah.
That was a great line.
I was trying to use the tone of the story to convey the ways in which this was and wasn't like the world that we actually live in. That is to say, it's the kind of thing, you know, this is exactly the kind of thing that happens when you're house hunting, is that there's something screwed up that they're just not mentioning in the real estate ad. But of course, in this world, it's perfectly reasonable that if you've got a decent portal that's a selling point. You know, and theirs is not so hot, which is why they should have stayed away from it.
Okay. But the funny thing, the thing about the real estate ad, which I just love, like when you're writing, so your stories are really serious. I mean, the underlying tone of the story, well, the tone of the story might be light, but the underlying message, or it's not necessarily a message, what would you say? The underlying sense of the story is really serious. There's stuff going on that's important. So when you are injecting humor into the story, does that ever? I mean, it must all come naturally. You can't be injecting it. Is that?
No, I'm not. I'm not just throwing shapes. I mean, I really do feel that life, even at its best, is, you know, is kind of dark and sad and depressing. But it's also hilarious and ridiculous, and we can kind of enjoy every moment of it that we should enjoy every moment of it that we can. And so, I was somebody told me after I gave a reading not long ago that all my readings kind of do the same thing, which is that I always pick something where I get everyone laughing really hard, but it always ends in appalled silence.
You probably know, like, appalled and guilty silence if you got them laughing first.
Maybe. But I like, you know, I think, and again, it's something that I enjoy in my reading as well. Like when I'm reading a book, I like to be caught off guard by things. I like to be led down a road, shown something that I think is one thing and actually shown that it's another thing, and to feel emotion that I didn't expect to be feeling given the tone of the story. And I think in my work I'm trying to be disarming, and I do that kind of with comedy. And once someone is disarmed, I'll bring out the big guns.
Do you find that the humor comes after you find the voice of the piece, or you know what I mean? Does it ever take you a while to figure out how this narration is going to flow? And then go.
I don't really think about the humor at all. I think I think it's just a natural part of my shtick.
Okay.
I do think about tone, though, and it is not unusual for me to fail to hit upon the right voice. But more likely, I get the voice right off the bat, and I don't have a story. So the thing that makes me give up on a piece that isn't working is usually not the voice. Occasionally, I'll discover a voice and eventually realize that the reason it feels so natural to me is that I've already done it 4 or 5 times, you know, and then I realize I've got to try something else. But another friend once said to me, I'd given him a novel I'd written, and I was concerned that it was so drastically different in style from the previous book that it would be essentially unrecognizable to the small audience I had built up. And he was like, no, you always just sound like you. Which was shocking to me. I really thought I was channeling some alternate version of myself, or that I was engaging in some kind of imitative or sort of mockingbirdy kind of act, you know. But in fact, I was just drawing on a different part of what is obviously me.
Okay. Did that upset you when he said that?
I kind of wanted to be like Mr. Genius Magical Ventriloquist Man. So I was a little disappointed, but ultimately I found it reassuring that because, you know, you go back to the writers you love because they're who they are. You want them to surprise you, but they also – you return to, you know, even if you don't like the last Haruki Murakami novel, you're going to read the new one because you want to be in that space,
right?
That space of sort of enigma and sort of childlike presentation, you know, that shtick he does so well.
Yeah.
And I like to think that there are people who are finding something in me that they're glad to see brought back out in a new form.
Yeah, absolutely. Now I'm going to go out of order again because you just said something that reminded me of one of my questions.
Sure.
Which is this. Okay, so in the story Ecstasy, you end, I'm not going to give anything away, but you end with this wonderful rumination about having an inappropriate reaction to a certain situation that was created in the story.
Yeah.
And then in another story, The Accursed Items, which I also want to talk about later, but there's this one part where the narration tells us about the guilt that a character feels, although it's entirely misplaced and due to something he has completely misunderstood. And I loved these moments, and I think it's related to what you were saying about sort of striking these unexpected emotions and having the reader not expect them and have to deal with all of the things that might come up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not expressing that well, but
that was more of a remark than a question, but
it was.
I'll respond to it anyway.
Here's what I said. Can you talk about your impulse to share these moments?
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. That makes sense. That's an actual question. Yeah. I feel like it's a fault of mine that I feel bad often about things that it's not productive to feel bad about. And
right.
Meanwhile, there are things I probably should feel bad about that I didn't even realize were mistakes.
Okay.
And that kind of, it's been useful for me to, once I got over the humiliation of being that person, which it does, you know, usually I can walk out in the world and not feel humiliated by my very existence. But writing in that space between feeling something about something or not feeling it, and then feeling inappropriately or not inappropriately, or choosing the right problem to try to solve or not solve versus choosing the wrong problem to try to solve. That kind of lost space, I think a lot of people's striving happens in that zone where mm-hmm. they're just working their little hamster wheel legs as fast as they can and having no effect whatsoever. Because there's problems we want to solve because it feels good to be solving that problem, but that's actually not the problem. It's a lot of effort we're spending to hide from ourselves the fact that the problem is elsewhere. And I think in small ways that's a thing in my life, but I'd like to sort of make that into a bigger thing in my fiction.
Okay. Do you think that the way that we feel when we sometimes feel like we're reacting inappropriately is created by television and how we see? do you think people assume that they should have a certain reaction because that's how it is depicted on television?
Maybe. It's you know, sort of the way, like, the sexual expectations of young people have been warped by pornography. You know, I do feel like the culture creates accepted norms for certain kinds of behavior, and then we find out that we try the things that we've seen or heard about, and they don't work.
Right.
You know, like, here's the proper reaction when you're bereaved. You know, here's the thing that you should do when you find out that your husband or wife is leaving you. Here's the thing you should do when your child is ill.
Right.
Here's the thing you do when the thing you want cannot be yours. And then you do the thing that you think society has told you is the correct thing to do, and it doesn't work. Because I feel like a lot of these sort of, and it's not just television, I think it's what our families teach us too. I think a lot of our lessons that we give ourselves and each other are aspirational rather than accurate. You know, it's almost like we're thinking, wouldn't it be nice if you could actually erase the way you insulted that person by saying these magic words? But of course, we leave out the wouldn't it be nice part, and we convince ourselves that that's actually going to do the job. And of course it doesn't, you know?
Right. Great. Okay. All right, well, let's talk about the accursed items, which is this wonderful, strange little piece that's in this. It's not strange, but it's different, that's in this collection. It's like a list story, except that some of the parts of it are really, really tiny, and some of them are more of a longer, but they're all single sentences, right?
No. Some of them are multiple sentences, but they're all fairly short, and it's almost like it's a little story collection in the middle of the story collection.
It is. It's like lots of flash stories in this one piece or something.
Yeah.
So how did you start writing that piece?
That's a good question. That's one of the oldest pieces, and I actually tweeted about that piece recently because I was writing a little essay about my history of using technology for writing for this blog that called The Cramped that I recommend. It's this guy Patrick Roan, who's interested in pens and pencils and notebooks and sort of what he calls analog technology, analog writing tech. And I'm into those things too, but I like computers as well. So I, over the years, whatever the latest thing that you could write on was, I would use that thing. I would try that thing out. And I actually wrote that on like a amber screened IBM PC using like WordPerfect and it was, I wrote it at my desk at the Art Museum of Missoula, where I was the receptionist in the mid-90s.
So you wrote The Accursed Items a long time ago?
Really long time ago, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, or most of it anyway. So I can't remember what the origin of it was. There were a couple of, but it might have been this, I think I put it in, I think it's actually in there. I've forgotten what I have actually put in the collection and what I have not, but I think there's like a dirty Mickey Mouse or Minnie Mouse doll in there somewhere.
Yeah. That's the thing that makes the guy feel guilty. That's completely misplaced.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that was a real thing. I think it was like an artifact that that my wife or I rescued, and it was around our house for a while. It was one of those things where you feel it looks forlorn, you know, you want to sort of save it from the side of the road, and then you get it home and you're like, why do I have this horrible thing that I found in the ground? my wife and I were kind of interested in objects, and we can always clutter up our house with junk. Not all junk; some of it's wonderful stuff that's interesting to have around, but a lot of it is clutter. And it's inevitable that, I mean, the reason we like it is often not because of its inherent properties, but because we can imagine some kind of narrative behind it. It seems like an artifact of some story. So it was kind of natural for me to start thinking about some of these things and where they might have come from. And then I sort of thought back to some of the objects that had passed through my life. You know, there's one where there's a, speaking of pornography, there's a gay men's porno magazine gets thrown out a car window onto a baseball field, which happened to me when I was playing baseball with some friends. These dudes just drove by and threw these magazines out the window. They're like, "Yeah, let's go check it out. Whoa! Here's a thing people do to each other? Really?" You know, and my... In my case, it was not a life-changing event, more just a slightly startling one. But yeah. It was very easy to imagine it taking a different turn if it had happened to someone else. So a lot of the things are like that. They're items I had seen or thought about and wanted to make up a story for.
Okay. Now, I said a little while ago that your stories have sort of like an underlying seriousness to them, even though they're funny and strange and wonderful. And I wondered how hard it is mixing all that up, like all these layers, you know, like do you ever have to kind of censor your humor because you feel like you're in a part that really should be more serious or, I mean, more like in revision? Do you find yourself having to juggle that stuff?
Yeah, I sometimes will yuck it up a little more, or I will cut back on some of the humor. I mean, it's hard to keep all the dosages of each thing in the right proportion, I think. Mm-hmm. So usually I'll get, you know, once I have a first or second draft that I think is fairly organized and, you know, makes sense, I'll give it to my wife. Is usually my first reader. I have a couple of friends I give stuff to as well, and they'll tell me what's wrong with it.
Okay.
But it often falls along those lines of there's not quite enough of thing X here. Sometimes more conventional things like, you know, we don't this character's poorly developed. You should do something. You should make his inner life more interesting. Or, you know, I think you're missing a. There should be another plot line here. Maybe you should try that. But a lot of the time it's making sure the weights of each thing are properly proportioned.
And which is more joyful for you, the first draft or the revision? Like,
short story is definitely the first draft. I really don't like revising short stories, and I have to drag myself back into them. I have three or four, actually, I really need to get back to, but I keep putting off. Novels... are long enough and they take long enough to write that I break through that wall and get onto a second wind that is as enjoyable, I think, as writing a first draft is. Mm. Okay. And I have that task awaiting me over my winter break, knock wood. But short stories, I have to drag myself back into them.
Okay. Will you set them aside for a while before you try to bring yourself back into them? Or
usually, usually. Yeah. The last one I wrote, I actually revised it really quickly after my first draft and just sent it right out. But it was short enough that I think I almost got it on the first try. It was all tone changes. Of course, it hasn't been published yet, so who knows if I'm even right that it's any good. But
okay. Do you write several things at the same time? Like, are you working on four stories in a novel all at once, or how does that work?
I usually... What is the truth there? If I'm really cooking on a novel, I won't do anything else. If I do, if someone asks me if I want to write a book review, mm-hmm. I may set aside a novel to write the book review, but that's a totally different kind of writing and a sort of different cognitive project than fiction writing is. I will definitely write other stuff between drafts of a novel. The novel that I've finished a draft of this summer, once I was done with it, I started doing like really short things in my notebook in a coffee shop. It was kind of my summer project, my late summer project and early fall project. But now I'm starting, you know, once this book tour is over, I'm going to start to gear up to go back into the novel and kind of live there for a couple of months.
Okay. After I first met you, I read your novel Familiar.
Oh, yeah.
I loved that. I so loved it. And today when I was preparing to talk to you, I found something that you had said in another interview. You were talking about familiar, and you said, we are all inventing our own realities for good or ill. I don't know if that's pulling some things out of the air and asking you to comment on it, but I was wondering if we could talk a little more about that comment.
Yeah, well, I think we're all walking around in a little world we've created for ourselves, and it might be one in which we're the star and everything we do is gold, and it may be one where we think that everyone is staring at us and hating us and thinking we're horrible, usually somewhere in between, I'd like to think. But, I mean, this is something a few years ago it occurred to me. Like, I'd published a certain number of books, and I'd had lots of students, and I thought I should probably know, like, what my career is like as a writer. You know, am I more or less famous than so and so? You know, and of course it's an absurd way to look at the world, right? But I naturally kind of went there, like, wait a minute, when I was just starting out and I admired writers who had published a lot, which of those do I correspond to now that I am in my 40s and have published a big bunch of books? And it's laughable, but I realized that I had this self-conception problem. Like, I wanted to be writing the narrative of my career. You know, the fact is, it's impossible to know what that's like from inside of it. In the same way that it's impossible to know what I'm like as a person.
Well, how did you approach trying to figure it out? Amazon sales ranking?
No, oh God, no, no. I'm never going to look at that. I think my main research tactic was to ask my wife, and she said
shut up.
Yeah, she's like, don't do that. don't do that. Your career is fine. Don't worry about it.
Oh, that's great. Is she a writer too, your wife?
Yeah, she is.
What's her name?
Rian Ellis. She wrote the novel Afterlife, which I highly recommend.
All right.
And is also a novel with a dark sensibility with some unexpected comedy in it. I saw her give a reading of it once, and as I did when I read it, people in the audience were laughing, and she actually looked up very startled.
Because she wasn't expecting it?
She was not expecting that, no. She didn't realize it was funny, but it's funny.
Hadn't you told her?
Oh, yeah, she didn't believe anything I say, though, about her.
All right. In the story called The Wraith, your main characters are described early on, sort of before things begin to change, this way. They regarded the world as working more or less as it should and concentrated on earning money, being married, and pursuing their various interests. They were content. When I read this, I thought, oh, they are America. And I wondered if that's about right. Were you trying to just sort of, or were they you? I mean, what does that describe, those people that were sort of just like content and everything's kind of going along and there's nothing ruffling their feathers and maybe they're not paying a lot of attention to the larger world?
Yeah, I like that. I like the notion that they're America.
Okay.
They don't correspond to real people in my life. So that story is in part inspired by my wife's and my sort of grumpiness about the Bush administration back in the 2000s. Right. Essentially, one of them is chronically depressed, and the other one is kind of blithely cheerful and energetic, and they don't think either one of them as having a problem, right? But in the same way that, I'm going to go with the America thing. It's like, we think of ourselves as these go-getters, and we're very industrious, and we're world leaders. You know, we're an example for people of other nations, but at the same time, slavery and the Native American genocide were like yesterday in historical terms. And the idea that we're past that and we're on to other things now is so ridiculous, it almost doesn't even bear saying. But it is on some level what we believe, and it keeps catching us by surprise, when it's suddenly revealed to us how dark it is to be an American.
Yeah.
And I think that's part what that story is about. And of course, the guy in that story thinks that he loves his wife in spite of her depression and misery, and it turns out that he is actually very attracted to her misery.
Right. And there's this great line that I'm not going to be able to find. There's this great line. So she's terribly depressed, and then there's a transformation that occurs, and so she is not always depressed anymore. She's very happy sometimes, and I won't get into that, but it was wonderful. I just loved this story. But there's this great line about how... Here it is. So he had not made love with his wife, you know, the way she used to be, in a long time. He missed her, the other one, the happy one. With her, it was too easy. His love needed something heavy to hold it down. I loved that. I thought that was such a great line. Like, he couldn't be with this person who was just, like, blithe and happy and not paying attention to anything else all the time. That was great.
Right, because she's the one, you know, on some level, he knows that his interface with the world is inadequate, you know?
Yeah.
And he needs the ballast of someone who actually sees it the way it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm struck in speaking with you about your stories about how well you understand them. And it's interesting. No, I think it's really interesting because I don't know that everybody does understand their own work as well as you do. Do you feel like that's unusual, or do you feel like that's more like the people you know? And
You may not be reading me correctly. I don't know that I understand it as well as you say I do. I think the truth about me is that I can argue any side of an argument, really.
Okay.
And when someone points something out to me about what I've done, I can immediately see the way that could be true.
They're Americans.
Kind of, yeah, right? So I don't know. So this, I mean, I enjoy these conversations simply because often people say stuff about my work that has never occurred to me. But once I hear it, I'm like, of course, that's the way it is. I meant it that way all along.
All right. I'm just going to step away from the collection for a minute. You're in a band, and you also have your own podcast. So these are two things in your life that are a little bit different than just the writing. So how do you see each of these as having a place in your creative life and alongside writing? I mean, are they just simply pastimes and fun, or do you?
I think the podcast is more related to my writing than the music. My partner on the podcast, Ed Skoog, was my friend in graduate school back in Missoula. He's a poet. His third book, Popular Imaginary Friends, is coming out, I believe, next year from Copper Canyon. But and we've always had a good rapport, and we've sent each other our work for a couple of decades. And I feel like he's kind of my writing therapist. You know, we talk about things other than writing, particularly food on our podcast, but but we've worked out a lot of sort of writing and career issues sort of in the public forum of the podcast as a result. And I'm really grateful to him for making that possible.
How often do you do a new podcast?
In theory, every week, but really it works out to about every 2 weeks. So we're up to, we've done 70 episodes in like 2.5 years, maybe.
Okay.
If we ever were like on a network or had, you know, ads or something, we'd have to get it together to actually do it every week. But as it is, he's got a little kid, and I've got a band, of course, and a job and all those other things. So
talk about the band. And do you write music for the band?
Yeah, this is a band that it started out with the three of the members of the band used to be students of mine. They were graduate students, and we were sitting in Fiction Workshop waiting.
You teach at Cornell, correct?
I teach at Cornell, yeah.
Okay.
And we just got talking about music as we were waiting for everyone to show up, and discovered that there was a drummer, a bass player, and a keyboardist, and a guitarist in the room. And so we joked that we should jam together, but then we actually did it. We just learned a bunch of covers and played them at a party, and really got along with each other musically. Better in my, I don't know about everybody else, but in my case, better than any other musicians I've ever worked with. So we decided to keep playing, and you can't really play gigs in Ithaca if it's not original music. So we all have written songs before, so we started doing it again. And we've been together for a couple of years, and we have an album coming out in a few weeks.
What's the name of the band?
The band is called the Starry Mountain Sweetheart Band. which is actually the name of a song from the first album that was written by Adam, our bass player.
Oh, okay.
About a fictional band. But it's at some point we were trying to figure out a good name for the band. We realized that was kind of us. So,
okay.
It's a song.
It's hard to come up with a new name for a band.
Yeah, we had jokingly called ourselves Emeritus, like a kind of gag. We found it on this list of band names we found on the internet, and like a randomly generated list of band names, and we thought it was funny that it was sort of like a joke about academia. But once we decided to become a real band and get serious about it, we needed a name. So
okay, all right. So how what's the album going to be called?
The first album was named after the band. We wanted to have one of those albums like Talk Talk or Bo Diddley, where there's like the artist, the album, and the song are all the same name.
Okay.
So we've discharged that duty to the world of rock and roll. And the new album is called The Hate of Love, and it's 12 songs. And because the book's coming out, we decided to do a book and CD release party at our favorite bar downtown. So we'll do that in a few weeks.
Are they publishing too? I mean, are you gonna do a book and CD party for other people? Are they still graduate students? Are they like how likely is that to happen?
The two remaining band members who were graduate students have now gotten their degrees, and they are temporarily lecturers at Cornell. Probably won't stay in Ithaca forever, but sadly. But yes, they will be publishing. Lauren, our other guitarist/keyboardist, just published her first story and is working on a novel.
Cool.
Adam has published a bunch of stories, including one in the Paris Review, and he's got a novel circulating right now.
Wow.
So.
Great.
They're really good, and they're going to publish before long. The same goes for our old drummer who's left the band, but is also about to start sending his novel around.
And what's your instrument?
I play guitar mostly and a little bit of keyboards.
Okay. So we were just talking about band names, and that brings me to another question I had for you. Your story titles are excellent.
Oh, thank you.
Titles of your stories. And I wondered if you could offer any advice on choosing titles or coming up with titles or figuring out titles.
I have occasionally spun a short story entirely out of a title.
Okay.
Because I wanted something to be called that. And at times I have written a story and just could not think of a good title. And it went right down to the wire and ended up being pulled out of the text by a magazine editor.
Okay.
So there's no rhyme or reason. I will say I love naming things.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of just thinking up goofy band names and novel titles and like fake memoir titles collections of poetry. One of my favorite and really irritating things to do is when someone utters unwittingly some phrase that tickles my fancy, I will just put colon poems after it. I do that on Twitter a lot. So yeah, I enjoy thinking up titles, and I like imagining what the titles might represent, how they might relate to the content of the story. The one that's sitting in front of me right now is No Life, and that one was a tough one. Like I couldn't think of a title for it, but I just pulled that out of the text.
Okay, and the title of the collection is See You in Paradise, which
yeah.
I should say anyway, and. That's also the title of a story. So did Grey Wolf ask to title the collection with that, or did you ask them to title the collection with that? Or
I liked The Accursed Items as a title. I liked The Wraith as a title. And we talked about Zombie Dan, but everybody decided zombies were a little played out, and Zombie Dan is not a canonical zombie.
No.
He's something else.
Now you're going to get all kinds of angry comments on anything because it wasn't the zombie story they were expecting.
No, it's definitely not. But I'm glad I didn't call it that. But my editor came up with, somebody at Grove came up with See You in Paradise as a title, and I was the only one who didn't like it. And then I finally just caved because it was so obvious that it was the right one and that I just had a blind spot. So now it's been in the pipeline long enough, so it feels right to me.
Now, do you think that maybe having the cover designed helped you accept the title, because the title and the cover go so beautifully together?
Yeah, the thing that I said to them was, and I should say, I don't know if other publishers are like this, but Grey Wolf is so awesome about letting writers having put into the book covers. This cover, they gave me 6 designs and I didn't like any of them. And then they gave me like another 6, and then we picked one of those and we tweaked the living hell out of it. And there was one point on the cover they ended up with, the word stories is written in like typewriter font on a little cloud, a little black cloud. And I said, I think my last note on the cover was, the cloud isn't cute enough. It should be cuter. And sure enough, like within an hour, they came back with a cuter cloud. I was so delighted. So I want to praise them for that. They were awesome. But yeah, the one thing I said to them beforehand was, I picture it as like a postcard. But a kind of ugly postcard. And that's what they eventually came up with. So I think their book designers are awesome.
It's a picture of a ranch house. I mean, this is paradise, right? So it's like a picture of a ranch house, but the colors are all not what you'd expect. And the sky is green instead of blue. And I thought it was perfect. So, and I like the title, but okay. Yeah. You like the title now, right?
I like it now. I like it.
Okay. Can you talk about what you're reading these days that you might recommend?
Oh, yeah. I've been reading a ton of comics. I didn't realize it existed until a few months ago, that Fantagraphics Books, which is one of the better publishers of graphic narrative, had a magazine called Mome that they published 22 issues of. I think they stopped a few years ago. But
how do you spell Mome?
M-O-M-E.
Okay.
I don't know what it means, but
but
it's great. It's a big thick pile of comics, and it features some of the best cartoonists of the past couple of decades. And then Word Brooklyn, the bookstore in Brooklyn, there's another Word in Jersey City, I think.
Okay.
And where I'm going to be reading in a couple of weeks, or depending when you broadcast this, a couple of weeks ago. They have a great comic section, and when I first went in there, I bought a bunch of comics, and I realized that I didn't know the forum well enough to be able to curate it for myself. So I just asked them. I gave them my credit card number and asked if they would just mail me something every month. So they've been doing that for like a year and a half now, and it's great. They're really terrific.
So it's like a comic of the month club.
Yeah, kind of. Personally chosen by the staff.
That's fun.
And I did read the new Haruki Murakami, and I was bewilderedly disappointed in it, but also liked it in a lot of ways.
Now, which one do you mean by the new one?
It just came out. What's it called?
Nope.
I don't know. It's got a long title. The something of colorless somebody or another. but it's got all the hallmarks of a Haruki Murakami novel, except that it just, all these different plot lines, they just all just stop, and nothing's ever resolved, to my bewilderment. I've been reading lots of student work because that's my job, and I have to say I enjoy it. I've been reading a lot of great stories by my graduate and undergraduate students at Cornell. So, bully for them.
Yeah, and the fact that your undergraduate students are included in that is great. I mean, the new students to writing and the more experienced students to writing.
Yeah, well, it's a different kind of thing. I think. I mean,
a different enjoyment.
Yeah, a different kind of enjoyment. I mean, sometimes an undergraduate will just already be awesome, and that's a rare treat. But I think that there's the pleasure in teaching undergraduates is that a lot of them have barely tried this, and they don't know what they're good at. Mm-hmm. And when you tell them, they're surprised. They often didn't know it was – they thought it was something else, you know? Because I think when you're young and you successfully sort of imitate something, you think that's your thing.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're doing this other thing you're not even aware of that no one else can do, and it's a pleasure getting to point that out to people and say, no, do more of that.
Yeah. That's great. It's great that you enjoy reading your student work. I wouldn't say that's everybody's experience, and that makes you a better teacher, I'm sure.
Well, I hope so.
I do want to know what you're writing these days or what's coming up soon.
I have been working on two things. One is a novel It's the moment it's called Ghosts, but I don't know if that will stick.
Like Zombie Dan, we don't want to mislead anyone. Is that it?
No. Well, they're different. You know, it sort of unpacks the notion of ghostiness in various ways.
Okay.
Maybe someone else said this, but I know that I've also said it, and that is, I feel like every story is a ghost story, and the ghost is the reader. Right, the reader, it's all for the reader.
Yeah.
Right, the characters aren't aware of you.
Yeah.
But it's all about you. You're observing them. You're drifting around in their life like a ghost, right? So there's a little narrative experimentation in it that's kind of ghostly.
That's fun.
Yeah, well, I have a draft of it, and it's kind of rough, but I've gotten a couple of sets of notes from my wife and a friend of mine, and they're both really, really good notes. So mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to revising that.
You have a draft already of it?
I've got a draft, yeah.
Okay.
And I've also been, for several years, been assembling another story collection of different kinds of stories, like many weird little experimental short shorts, assignments I've given myself, prompts.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff that people have asked me for something, for an anthology with a very specific and peculiar theme.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've written something for that. And slowly this has sort of built up into a thing that feels a little bit like a book.
Cool. That's fun.
I actually gave it to Ed, my podcast partner. And when we recorded the podcast the other day, I asked him what he thought. And he said, it's almost a book, but I think you need to stick a novella into the middle of it. So now I got to think about that. Maybe I'll do it.
Okay. Or a graphic novel. But
oh, God.
Then you'd have to find somebody to draw it for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I should probably do that. I did a project with my friend Lou where he did these sort of Photoshopped versions of old postcards and photos, and he would send them to me, and then I would write short stories based on the pictures.
Oh, cool.
And that's, you can get that as an ebook on Amazon, but it's called The Great Zombini. But I'm usually allergic to collaboration. I always feel it's going to be a nightmare, and I'm going to want it to be one way, and the other person will want it to be the other way. But in reality, it usually is just fine. Somewhere
okay.
between fine and awesome, actually.
I think I would be worried about the opposite. I'd be worried I would just be like, oh, that's fine. Okay.
Yeah, right.
We'll do that.
I'm good with whatever. Anything to avoid conflict.
Exactly. okay. Well, this was really fun. I actually enjoyed having the video going here. I should take a screenshot. Hold on. Yeah. Now I'll put that on the site, too. Okay.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you. This was really fun. I really enjoyed the book. I'll just say one more time, it's See You in Paradise, published by Grey Wolf Press, J. Robert Lennon.
Thank you very much. It was great talking to you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with J. Robert Lennon, which took place obviously long before COVID and all the Zoom meetings, and now I do all of my interviews practically with a camera on. But anyway, you can learn more about his work at jrobertlennon.org. So this week's Write the Book prompt is to write a paragraph about a moment that takes place in a park. Maybe a dog breaks free of her leash and runs away from her owner. Write about whatever moment you choose to present, and then write the paragraph again from two different perspectives. So in that example, you might write perhaps from the perspective of the dog or another dog or a person who feeds birds from a bench or a person who sleeps on a bench, a policeman, somebody that you think of. See what happens to the moment that you are creating when you let it be seen through these varied perspectives at a park. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. And that's where you can get all the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are also available wherever you get your podcasts, so you can just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it with people who might enjoy it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.